It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, eating your fruits and veggies just got even more important. A nutritional psychiatrist tells us why the food we eat could have a big impact on our mental health. Now, as we look back at the first full school year during the pandemic, one major challenge turned out to be cheating. Remote learning led to a surge in academic dishonesty among students from grade school to college. Among the methods used, simply doing online searches for answers, texting friends, or looking at notes. You can submit a question on various websites for experts to answer. You can even post an assignment online and take bids from people who are willing to do the work for you for money. Even with schools reopening their doors, educators are worried that cheating will continue. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. How worried are you about students cheating in school? If you're a teacher or a professor, what did you do to try to minimize cheating? Did a rise in cheating change the way you cheat? If you're a parent or a student yourself, what kind of things did you see? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Tawnell Hobbs is a senior special writer covering education at the Wall Street Journal. Tawnell, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You had a recent piece where you focused on colleges here. Before we get to the specific methods of cheating, just how widespread was it during this year of online education?
It was so widespread. I don't think I can't recall when I called so many colleges and schools, and I don't think anyone said that cheating was not up. They all said that they had noticed a big increase. They were trying to deal with it. And also, a lot of universities put their academic integrity stats online. So we started analyzing that, too. It was just widespread throughout the country.
And that's so if we're just measuring people actually getting caught cheating, it was up. Right. And presumably, there are some people who cheated and didn't get caught, too, along the way.
Exactly.
So this all comes from this year of online education. I don't know. It seems like schools at all levels were scrambling in how to do it. Was that part of the problem that everyone was just kind of making it up as they went?
No, that is definitely part of the problem. I mean, remember when the pandemic was called, everybody had to immediately switch to remote learning. They had to get laptops to kids. Everybody had to get online. And then, you know, there were security issues. You had a lot more schools getting hacked. So there just was not a lot of focus on the academic integrity part of it. You know, there were some people that were like, look, let's just make sure they can learn online and, you know, we'll deal with everything once we get them back in school. And that's really how it went. But now there's obviously concerns.
And cheating or sort of gray area stuff. I mean, I know people have been selling term papers online for years, but it's a big business now. Could you talk about some of the sort of commercial operations?
That's like the ancient way to cheat, right? That's like so old now. Basically, these newer ways, you can obviously go on some of these sites. You can pay your membership. Monthly memberships can go as low as $10, and you can basically have access to all of their questions, which, you know, a lot of these sites have millions of questions that have been loaded up by students who are cheating. They load up their exam questions, or you have people that are there that will just answer their questions for you, and they can do it at a moment's notice. And of course, you have the auction sites, and that's a big thing where, you know, you can almost go shopping for who you want to do your work now.
And you actually put this to the test. You put out a call for bids. What happened?
I did. We did that with a couple of sites. We actually had did an assignment, and it was titled Wall Street Journal's Seeking Help to Cheat or something like that. And we put it on the bid sites, and we were very detailed about, you know, who we are. We're doing this for sure. We're not paying anything, you know, and we just were very clear. And the bids just started rolling in, and we started engaging with people. And, you know, one guy was going to charge us $2,000. I mean, the bids range from like $15 to $2,000, but they got on there and they were just literally bidding to do that assignment for us. We got it up in like seconds. It was that fast.
Wow. And you also talked to some of the sites that offer various kinds of help for subscription or bids. What did they say about when you asked them if they were encouraging cheating?
You know, there were, I mean, we talked to a decent amount of the sites, and surprisingly everybody responded. Most people did anyway. And the response I got, especially from some of the bigger, you know, sites that people know, you know, that have the name recognition, you know, they say that they're there to help students learn. They're there for, you know, you can get help studying, and all of them have disclaimers on their site saying, you know, don't use this work to turn in for your own benefit and things like that. But of course, you know, they all acknowledge that if somebody is paying you $100 or $200 or several hundred to take their online class, okay, there's not much wiggle room with that. So they do realize that cheating happens. They think there's more students that are being honest, and they also feel like they are filling a gap right now because online learning has been pretty tough on some students. So they feel like they're there to help too.
We're talking to Tawnell Hobbs from the Wall Street Journal about cheating in academia, colleges, K through 12, you name it, during the pandemic and at home education. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you have taught people in the last year, did you see more cheating? Did you try to prevent it in some ways? If you're a parent, a student yourself, have you heard stories? Have you checked out these sites? And did you have a friendly camera on your computer at some point watching you take a test? Call 800-642-1234. And Tawnell, let's get into that, the proctoring services now that keep an eye on me while I'm taking my tests.
Oh, yeah, that right there. You know, and that could be a bit contentious because you could have someone watching you through your webcam. And so there's some concerns with that, too. But also, those companies really grew. They picked up millions of, you know, different or they proctored millions more papers. And it was interesting because all of them that I talked to, they said that these sites, there were just ways that kids were cheating that you would not expect. And a lot of the universities especially went to these proctoring companies because you still have to give exams, you still have to give tests, right? Mm-hmm. So they're like, how can we do this? We need these kids to be watched. And it's just not a live proctor. Sometimes you have a situation where they have the face of recognition. If your eyes stray too much, that might get you a ding. Or, you know, maybe somebody comes in the room and you turn your back. So there's different situations with that. But yeah, proctoring was used a lot and those companies really did grow.
Did I read this right? One proctoring site reported that a young girl taking a test sneezed, went off camera, and was replaced by a dude in a wig taking the rest of the test.
That is so true. Yeah, the student, she's taking this exam, she sneezes, she's out of camera view at that point, and then this person reappears in a blonde wig, impersonating her. And obviously she got busted. But that's just the extent of how some of this cheating went.
Points for creativity, I guess. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jesse is with us in Appleton. Jesse, hi.
Hello. I definitely agree that, you know, we definitely need to be teaching integrity, and there's something to be said about doing the right thing and not cheating. But I also think that we haven't quite picked up on, you know, that this is a long time coming. We have a lot of information at our fingertips, and we're still expecting kids to have this rapid recall. You know, what were the years that Abraham Lincoln was president? Is it really necessary anymore? And, you know, are we only cheating ourselves and thinking that we can, you know, require our students to think this way instead of teaching them to be resourceful and to think outside the box? You know, my daughter was in first grade and she didn't know the answer. And so she went and asked a friend and her teacher said, oh, you know, she cheated. And I said, well, wait a minute. We've taught her to be resourceful and ask questions like, yes, you know, she needs to follow the rules. And we'll talk to her about that. But there's also just a different idea of how we measure intelligence and how we deem proof that we have it.
Interesting, Jesse. And I've heard this argument elsewhere, Tawnell, that, hey, in the real world, we collaborate with other people and we can look stuff online. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, that was a great call. She's right. I mean, it is an issue. And I know a lot of schools, for a student in this day and age, open book in my age meant you go get your book and you get to do an exam open book. To these kids, open book means the internet. And there's a lot on the internet. And I noticed that especially some of the universities had started being very detailed with what was allowed, because obviously students are going to do research. They're going to do research. Oh, I don't know that they're going to get on there. But there's a fine line between doing that and, you know, going and grabbing the exam or paying for access to an exam online, or paying somebody, auctioning off your homework and paying somebody to do your homework.
Thanks a lot for that call. We are talking about cheating in schools at all levels with Wall Street Journal reporter Tonnell Hobbs. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about cheating in schools, especially during the pandemic and with online education? Are you worried it's going to carry over beyond COVID? Or do we need to change the way we teach and evaluate kids to match the real world a little better? And do you have experiences as a teacher, instructor, student, parent that you want to share with us? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about cheating at school with Tonnell Hobbs. She's a senior special writer at the Wall Street Journal. She recently wrote about our year of online learning and how it's made different kinds of cheating easier and more common at all levels of school. That is, some educators worried it's going to carry over after the pandemic is over. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences with online education, the risk of cheating in one way or another. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Stu is with us, calling from Western Wisconsin. Stu, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about, Stu?
My 16-year-old daughter and I got engaged and got in a wrestling match. And, you know, basically almost escalated to screaming because I told her she couldn't change, that her entire future was dependent upon the integrity of her education, and tests and assignments were a measure of that. And she started cursing at me and telling me that a bunch of junk about whether the tests were biased, and I'm a mathematician, PhD mathematician. It's very tough to have cultural problems in the testing system, at least in math. And it certainly is biased in English and medicine and all sorts of other stuff. But
gotcha. Stu, thanks a lot for calling in. So arguments in households, Tonnell, even about, yeah. A little more evocative than I expected. What do you think? Is this something you think a lot of parents are dealing with?
There are parents dealing with this. And, you know, actually, I had talked to a parent, and her concern, it, you know, she knew her daughter was cheating. Some parents know it, but they're, you know, it's been a tough year, they reason, for their kids and them too. But her concern was that, and this is a concern, that her daughter cheated all of Spanish 1. So how is she going to go in the fall and take Spanish 2? And that is actually a concern with some parents, especially ones that know their kids have cheated, because now they have to go in person and it's harder to cheat like that, right? I mean, yeah, you could still probably do it in some ways. And I imagine there's going to still be some entities doing a little online learning. But that is a big concern, because some of these kids who have spent the year cheating, some students have not been in a physical classroom in a year. Some schools don't allow you to, you know, they don't require or allow kids to turn on the webcam. So who knows who's sitting in front of the laptop? So there is a concern that these kids might return in the fall and they've literally missed a whole year.
Thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. And yeah, Tonnell, I know there's concern among some of the educators you talk to that some of these problems are going to persist. Some might not be as easy to pull off, but some of them will. And maybe there's an attitude change here. I don't know. What kind of things are they worried about?
They're worried about, because now you've kind of opened up this world, you know, for these kids, because it's like, oh my God, I can pay $10 a month and I can get on this site anytime I want and pose a question and it's going to get answered in seconds. So that is the big concern. Now it's like, have you created a whole new generation of cheaters? because a lot, it is pretty easy. Like you said, we went on there and put our own work up for auction, and within seconds, we had it up within 1 minute. Within seconds, we had like 13 bidders willing to do the work, as low as $15. And that is the concern, that now that this world has been opened up to kids, will they be able to leave it alone? And I will tell you, some of these sites that I talked to that have noticed that they've gained millions of users during the pandemic, they strongly believe that they're going to hold those students. They do. They think they're going to keep coming back.
Talking to Tawnell Hobbs from the Wall Street Journal about concerns about cheating, online cheating, especially during the pandemic and at-home learning. You can join in with your thoughts or your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to our callers now. Jill is with us in northern Wisconsin. Jill, hi.
Hi. Okay. See, schooling should be reading, writing, and arithmetic, the three R's. It should be reading, respect, and responsibility. If children had respect for themselves and others, they wouldn't do this. And if they had at least an idea that they're responsible for their education, we wouldn't have this problem either.
Jill, thanks for the call. Tawnell, how much of the solution are people reached for there to try to, I guess, have a sense of ethics going into these cheating situations?
You know, what I've seen and the people I've talked to, there's a lot of reasoning going on. Like, well, it is a pandemic. You got to kind of do what you got to do to get by. I mean, I've talked to professors that when they've caught students cheating, that's been the response. We're in a pandemic. How can you do this to me? How can you put me on academic probation? This is a pandemic. So there's a lot of reasoning going on. And will that change in the fall when a lot of kids go back? You know, perhaps, but there still was a lot of reasoning during the pandemic trying to justify why it's okay to cheat. There's parents, too, that also turned a blind eye on this.
Well, talking a little more about consequences, we saw the schools included here, West Point, where I think if you get caught cheating, there are serious consequences. Can you talk about the kind of scandals we've seen and what ended up happening to students who got caught?
Yeah, West Point, we actually broke that story. And that was a big thing because apparently they had a policy that had been there for years that if they owned up to, you know, what some kind of infraction or whatever, again, like an honor type of infraction, if they admitted to it, then they could actually stay on at West Point. So what happened is you had during this pandemic, you had a whole bunch of students who had cheated on an exam, and they just all kind of said, oh, we admit to it. And so they got to stay. So what they end up doing there is they got rid of that rule. So they can't use that anymore. And then there's an academic probation. There's so much stuff that the kids have to deal with. But it wasn't just West Point. You know, the Air Force Academy, they caught cheating there too. The Naval Academy. I mean, there were other academies. I mean, when I tell you this cheating was so widespread, it was widespread.
What kind of things do you see, and again, you focus in this piece on colleges, doing, looking toward this fall to try to prevent, catch, root out various kinds of cheating?
Well, I think, too, that I think they're going to be more vigilant because I think that educators know, wow, this whole world of cheating has been opened up to these kids. So they're going to watch it. What they realize too is that a lot of schools, especially at the K-12 level too, they use the plagiarism software. You know, like if you go and you copy something off of the internet, they could scan it through some plagiarism software and you're busted. Well, nowadays there's a lot of original work where the work is original, so these plagiarism software type programs will not catch it. So I think everybody's kind of gotten a little smarter about this. Even, you know, the educators, they're looking for it now, but they are concerned not only that the kids are going to come back a year behind, but also that they have been opened up to this world of, you know, kind of free cheating here.
Speaking of educators getting onto this, a little intelligence style tradecraft. One professor, a statistics professor at North Carolina State, gave unique questions on a test to each student to see which ones appeared on these sites.
Yeah, that guy. Wow. Yeah. He was suspecting that kids were cheating. So there was some program that actually, for each question, it would change it a little bit, whether it was to add a word, a comma, or just do something really unique. So every student in that class, and there was hundreds, they all had kind of unique exams. I mean, that were unique to them. So when he gave his final exam, and as those questions started appearing on the cheating sites, he knew exactly who it was. And on this site, which is called Chegg, this site, he ended up working with this site, and not only were they able to get the kids who posted on it, but also everybody who had looked at the questions. So if you're taking the exam, it's like, oh, I don't need to post that. Somebody else did. And you look at the answer. Well, they got those kids too. And there were like 200, about 200 of them caught cheating. Wow.
So as we wrap up, Tonnell, what are you watching for next on this ongoing cheating story?
Well, what I'm watching for next, because especially as we go back into the fall, I am watching for one to see how many of these education entities still, you know, are using proctoring services. I've been told that there will still be online classes, you know, that they use, or at least they'll use more than in the past. So I would imagine that they're trying to find a way to kind of offset this cheating. I know proctoring has been a big thing. I'm trying to see what else they have up their sleeve, because they know it's a problem. They know it's a problem. And there's obviously a concern, too, that you've had a whole year not in the classroom, and especially if there's been a lot of cheating, what do kids really know? How much do you have to go over? Are they ready for the next level? So they're focused on that, too. But they really are looking at how can we head off this cheating. Now, I know one university, Texas A&M University, they had actually hired some students and trained them to be proctors of their own, you know, peers. So they're going to be trying different things. So I'm watching for that.
Tonnell, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Tonnell Hobbs is a senior special writer at the Wall Street Journal. We talked to her about the increase in cheating at schools during the pandemic, how easy it's become, and how schools and colleges are reacting. Coming up after the news, the food you eat can play a big role in how you feel, especially when it comes to mental health issues, including anxiety and depression. We'll talk to an author and nutritional psychiatrist. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, the pandemic has inspired some people to make big changes in their lives and careers, and it's forced some people to make those changes. A business and career expert joins the show with some advice, and you can share your big changes. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, if you're eating potato chips and pizza all the time, you might not physically feel your best, but research shows that your mental health could also suffer. A growing field called nutritional psychiatry connects the food we eat to our brain function and our mental health, and it can even play a role in how we experience things like depression or anxiety. Our next guest suggests we think of our brains as expensive machines to run, and they require key ingredients and attention to our food choices. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has a mental health professional ever talked to you about food? And if you're in the mental health field, what do you think of this idea? And for anyone, has a diet change ever impacted your own mental well-being? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Drew Ramsey is a psychiatrist, author, and farmer. He's an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons and founded the Brain Food Clinic in New York City. His new book is called Eat to Beat Depression and Anxiety, Nourish Your Way to Better Mental Health in 6 weeks. Dr. Ramsey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, it's so great to be with you and with Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm so excited to talk about food and mental health and nutritional psychiatry, especially right now.
And you paint a picture of, I guess, a lot of untapped potential here from what we know about food and mental health to how much we apply it. How much more could we be doing?
I think for most people, the simple answer is a lot more. I'd even put myself in that category, somebody who spends a lot of time thinking about this. And that really is the promise, in some ways, the hope of nutritional psychiatry, that we start thinking about our brains and our brain health and our mental health with our lifestyle choices like food. I think there's a huge potential, Rob. Maybe we can talk to you and some of the callers who call in and see if we can offer up a couple of little brain health nutritional tweaks to help everybody deal with all of the emotional stuff going on right now.
Definitely. We'll spend a lot of time, I think, on some of the specific foods we can work into our diets and ways we can do it. But can you talk about some of the emerging research that's really nailing down the connection between, again, our diet, our food choices, and our mental well-being?
All right. And Rob, if people are hearing it, my horses behind me neighing, just don't.
I heard there were horses.
Yeah.
We've met a lot of great animals over the course of the pandemic.
And so, let's just think about the research in terms of the data that really matters, the gold standard in medicine, which are randomized clinical trials. And randomized clinical trials are where we test an intervention versus a control intervention or a placebo. And there's been a lot of connection between food and mental health, correlational data. For example, if you look at a population eating the Mediterranean diet over time, there is a reduction in the risk of depression or a lower risk of depression compared to folks eating a more Western style diet. And that data exists for a lot of traditional diets, but it doesn't really matter in medicine until we have randomized trials. So now there have been five for about food intervening specifically to treat clinical depression. And four of those trials were positive. And they look something like this. People who have mild to moderate depression get some instructions and coaching around the Mediterranean style diet, usually in these studies. In our clinic, we focus on food categories. Not that this is the only end all be all treatment in mental health. I don't think anybody in the mental health either field or is mental health problems thinks that's true. But that there's more, as you say, we can do. And that this expensive machine runs on specific sets of fuel. And there are a lot of foods and fuels and nutrients that really are missing in the Western diet. The most impressive data, Rob, was the SMILES trial. This came out in 2017, so quite recently. It looked at over 60 individuals and tested the Mediterranean-style dietary intervention. It found of those individuals who are already in treatment, a full third went into full remission, which for those of us in psychiatry, that's really the holy grail that we're looking for in terms of treatment. We don't want people's symptoms just to get a little better. We want people to get all the way back to their normal selves when it comes to illnesses like depression and anxiety.
Talking to Dr. Drew Ramsey about his new book, Eat to Beat Depression and Anxiety, Nourish Your Way to Better Mental Health in 6 Weeks. Well, let's start naming names with those food categories you mentioned. I looked at, you've got a list of 12 really key brain nutrients, and for a lot of them, leafy greens are ways to get them. And that's the first step in your 6-week plan, is to get some leafy greens in our diet. Tell us the story of these greens.
The story of leafy greens really comes to where I found these 12 nutrients. And these 12 nutrients came from my colleague, Dr. Laura LaChance, and I, also a psychiatrist. We looked at all the scientific literature and all the studies of depression that looked at specific nutrients. And we found that there are 12 nutrients that really have good support, that they can both help prevent mental health symptoms like depression, but also when you're having those symptoms, help treatment, either meaning the studies have shown there's a better outcome. So these nutrients, most people have heard of a lot of them, the omega-3 fats, B12, zinc, magnesium, selenium. We then look at what food groups have the most of those. And leafy greens per calorie, because that's in nutritional psychiatry, we try and think about nutrient density. So we're really looking not just for foods that are low calorie, we're looking for foods that have a lot of nutrients. That's the most important question, especially specifically these brain or what we call antidepressant nutrients. So leafy greens are great. And specifically what I find clinically people struggle with, and maybe people listening relate to this, when we say greens, people think salad. And salads are great, but I have to be honest, I eat most of my greens sauteed or in stews or with pasta, or as a kale chip. So there are a lot of diverse ways to get more greens into your diet. And again, the reason is nutrient density. Just get so many nutrients per calorie, things like vitamin C, folate, fiber. And then one last, it's phytonutrients. Anytime we're talking about plants, it's not just these vitamins and minerals. One of the reasons that people are so excited about plants' health effects have to do with these phytonutrients, plant-based nutrients. They're molecules plants use to protect themselves. And we've co-evolved with them in a way that they signal to our genes to really fight illness in some pretty amazing ways.
And let's talk about kale. You've written a whole book about kale. You describe yourself, I think, as a recovering kale evangelist or something like that. Kale's great, yeah. But you say it doesn't have to be kale. We can find, and this is true of all these categories, we can find the ones that work for our lifestyle and our personal taste buds.
So first, kale, if you're out there listening, baby, I still love you. I do. I love you, my pesto. I had some baby kale today in my smoothie. And I just want to say that first of all, because there's a lot of kale hating going on. Kale haters, you know, Rob, what are you going to do? But I've evolved and I've understood after really being hired by the Kale Mafia to promote kale nationally and internationally. I learned that people need more than kale. I learned that when some people don't like kale, and that's fine, because there are lots and lots of other leafy greens. And that's where I learned about food categories. And it's fine with me. You don't ever have to eat kale. In fact, I'm on a bender of sunflower sprouts this summer so far. It's like probably for about a year now been my favorite leafy green. I'm big on arugula, radicchio, ridiculous, amazing for your health. And so those are the ways that you want to kind of think about it, is think about your leafy green consumption. Like, how many different types of leafy greens did you eat if you're a greens eater? Or if you didn't, like, why not? Are they bitter? Do you not like how they taste? Do you not know how to make pesto? So there's this sort of, in nutritional psychiatry, I think this notion, instead of like shaming and blaming and creating fear, I really want to help motivate people and create excitement, just as I do in my clinical practice, to start feeding their mental health, to get active, to start expanding your palate and your options as an eater. The data says this helps people fight depression and anxiety. It also helps people save money. In the SMILES trial, people saved $140 a month as they started to incorporate more of these really, again, high nutrient dense, healthy foods that are also many of them really, really affordable and should be in your diet plan all the time. So leafy greens, one category. We then move on, Rob, to rainbow vegetables. I think we should tell everybody a 6-week plan, because, you know, if we had a pandemic, everybody's mental health is
let's take a couple minutes and we will hit that 6-week plan. We're talking to Dr. Drew Ramsey about his new book, Eat to Beat Depression and Anxiety. He's an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. He says the food we eat can, if we make some good choices, boost our mental well-being. And we don't have to make radical changes in our diet to do it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about what kind of foods you could eat to help your mental well-being? Have you experienced this? A change in your diet that made you feel better or made you feel worse mentally and emotionally? If you're a mental health professional, have you looked into the relationship between food and mental health? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Dr. Drew Ramsey. His new book is called Eat to Beat Depression and Anxiety. He's an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the relationship between food and mental health? Do you have an experience to share? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Okay, Dr. Ramsey, we promised to get into the 6-week plan. Part one was those leafy greens we were talking about. Give us the rest of that that roadmap, please.
All right. Well, number two is pretty easy. Number two is you test by just looking at your plate. And do you see a bunch of beige, typical Western diet, or do you see colors? Do you see a variety of colors? We like to say rainbow colors. In the book, I call them brainbows. And the idea behind these is by seeing a variety of natural colors on your plate, it generally means you're getting a variety of those phytonutrients, but also a variety of plants. And the importance with variety in plants really comes down to a few things. One is more of those phytonutrients. Another is just a bigger diversity of nutrients and fiber.
All right. We've got the rainbow. And we're not talking about rainbow-colored sprinkles on my donut, though I do like those. Those don't count. Hit us with some of those other great food groups.
It's not those. I've had patients come in, they show me the gummy bears and they're like, they joke like, I'm eating the rainbow, doc. It's like, not the gummy bear rainbow, folks, like the real rainbow, Mother Nature's rainbow. Another food category then that's just super important for people that often we struggle with. I grew up in Indiana. I'm a farm boy.
seafood is not part of the game plan. I'm in fish sticks in the cafeteria. I then moved to New York, and about the same time I was finishing my residency, a lot of science started coming out about the long-chain omega-3 fats and mental health risk, and mental health outcomes. And I thought, you know, if I'm really going to be like a brain health guy, I need to learn more about how to eat seafood. Seafood is a key brain food category because it's really our only source, bioconcentrated source, meaning you can eat it in food, of long-chained omega-3 fats. Not the long-chain, not the omega-3s you get in flax, but the omega-3s that you get in sardines, oysters, wild salmon, anchovies, or some of, and mussels. Those are really five of the fish and seafood I tend to recommend people try to get involved with and begin to experience.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Daryl is with us in Toma. Daryl, hi.
Hi, Rob. I had an experience and a question here. So 2 years ago, I did the keto diet along with exercise, and I lost about 85 pounds. But I also had a very good improvement on what I thought was mental health and job performance improvement. I did had a much better year at my job. So I was wondering if you know, the speaker had done any research on the keto diet and mental health. Also, the second thing, sushi. Every time I eat sushi, I feel better. I don't know if it's just fresh. I love it, and you know, it's just great. So if there's anything there too, that'd be great. Thank you.
Daryl, thanks. That's a lot to work with. Let's start with keto, Dr. Ramsey.
Well, Daryl, you first of all, great questions. Thank you. When Daryl went on keto, he shifted the type of fuel his brain was using to eat more ketones. And as he broke down those 85 pounds, probably mostly fat, he was feeding it to his brain. So the fact that you felt more cognitive clarity or more cognitive performance, that makes a lot of sense to me. You're going to get that just from any weight loss. Studies of bariatric surgery show something like 13 to 16 IQ point improvements as we improve our metabolic health. Not that everybody needs to be skinny, but that as we lose weight and go to a more natural weight, that our cognitive powers and brain improve, our risk of depression goes down. So part of what Daryl noticed in terms of mood and cognitive performance, that makes total sense. In terms of specifics with keto, there is a study long-term of keto diets, again, low carbohydrate diets, usually done under some supervision, just because you can get into some issues there. But there is some data of a little bit more, again, cognitive clarity. One of the thoughts here is that ketones are a little more efficient to burn. And this is why, as people are exploring like intermittent fasting and different types of lower, maybe not full keto, but lower carbohydrate diets, I get really excited because I think it has lots of impacts for improving our overall brain health and metabolic health. And Daryl, of course, sushi makes you feel delicious makes you feel amazing because sushi is delicious. And I wonder if it might be one of those places that you're getting those omega-3 fats. I also think sushi is one of those very sensual, pleasurable, kind of slower meals. Like you don't wolf down sushi. You kind of sit down and enjoy it. And I think sometimes we focus so much on all the nutritional psychiatry data and nutrients. We forget one of my favorite parts of nutritional psychiatry, which is eating food and nourishing yourself and being with other people and exploring your palate. That's really good for our mental health. You know, it's why a night out feels good to us. It's why we meet up with friends and have dinner and we feel great. And sometimes it doesn't depend what we're eating. It could be pizza. And I think that's just an important aspect maybe of what Daryl's talking about also is, you know, part of nutritional psychiatry, I would say in the book, people read a lot about this. I have a chapter called Eat or Heal Thyself. And it's really asking people to take a step back from diet culture and think about more joyfulness and more nutrient density is really first and second steps for how to improve your diet and how you eat.
Daryl, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Dr. Drew Ramsey about his new book, Eat to Beat Depression and Anxiety. Back to your calls now. Lisa is with us in Brookfield. Lisa, hi.
Hi. Hi. I was just wondering, I didn't know if you talked about this. I just got on, but Daniel in the Lion's Den, I think it was, he asked the king if he could just eat vegetables while everyone else was eating whatever they were eating, and he got wiser, if that's the word. So I was just wondering, does eating well help your IQ or help you be smarter?
Lisa, thanks. Eating to boost our IQ, Dr. Ramsey. Can we do it?
Yep. I think there's some data on this specifically around how we think about nutrition during pregnancy, not to stress out new moms or expectant mothers in any way, more to just that there should be encouragement. And I think it's not just in utero. So some of the data is more seafood, less garbage, healthier food is good for overall brain health, mental health outcomes, and specifically verbal IQ. I've seen some data around studies where they give pregnant women wild salmon. I also think because this new way that we think about the brain, and I talk about this in the book, Eat to Beat Depression and Anxiety, is kind of a request that people reconceptualize things. I find so often people just think about depression like serotonin or chemical imbalance or problems. But really, there's a lot of new science around how the brain grows, about how things we do in our life lead to more inflammation, and how that creates a lot of headwinds for us to be our most, when we think about intelligence, like that's creativity. That's not just like, I'm good at the SAT. That's also our intelligence is in how we relate to people, how we process our emotions, how we are generative to others. I mean, that all requires very kind of higher echelon of our brain and our IQ. And so I'm biased. So I'm a firm believer that the more we take care of our brains, the more our brains take care of us. And the data increasingly backs me up on that, thank goodness.
Thanks a lot for that call, Lisa. Now, we've talked mostly, Dr. Ramsey, about foods we want to eat some more of. And I think you're pretty careful to say, you're not looking for drastic changes. You're not saying never eat these things. But what kind of foods do we want to dial down as we bring up our, our leafy greens, our rainbow vegetables, and our seafood?
Yeah, so these are the ones that people hear about a lot. I think they don't connect it to their mood, their anxiety, and the risk of depression and dementia as much as they should. Again, not to scare everyone, but to sorry, I just see that my horse is out wandering in the field. Cinco. Sorry about this.
That's a first. Right. No, that's fine. That's fun.
Yeah, it's a first for me. So he's a pretty tame guy. Let me walk over here to him. That was just a little stuff not to eat. So let's avoid processed foods, meaning you're opening a package of some type and you are not reading the ingredients list. Some things like I'm a parent, you're kind of racing around. Sometimes you've got to have some convenient foods, but the point is to avoid simple and refined carbohydrates and sugars, avoid things that have a lot of unpronounceables and unnatural ingredients. There's something like 40,000 new molecules in the grocery store. And I'm not here to fearmonger, say they're bad. I'm just nobody's saying or thinking that they're good for your mental health. And so those are a couple. I also liquid sugars. We talk about so much about what we eat, and we often don't talk enough about what we drink. And I think that we have so much liquid sugar in our, come here, Cinco. We have so much liquid sugar in our diet and so much, alcohol for most Americans. And it just leads to a kind of, again, a real headwind where you end up quite hungry. You end up quite metabolically dysregulated in terms of just, a lot of insulin and a lot of changes in your blood sugar. And again, we feel that. That's an issue in terms of mental health.
We'll leave it there, Dr. Ramsey. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob. It's great to be with anybody. I hope everybody in Wisconsin just hears my encouragement to feed your mental health, too. Especially, it's Mental Health Action Day, Rob. And so specifically, we've been in Mental Health Awareness Month, but today really take an action for your mental health. Thank you so much.
That's Dr. Drew Ramsey, psychiatrist, author, and farmer. And horse owner. He's an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons and founded the Brain Food Clinic in New York City. Been talking about his latest book, Eat to Beat Depression and Anxiety, Nourish Your Way to Better Mental Health in 6 Weeks. Hey, if you've found a way to successfully add some of these healthier foods into your daily routine to build a habit about it, let us know about it. Send us an email, ideas@WPR.org. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, should Wisconsin keep accepting enhanced unemployment benefits from the federal government? There have been some calls, especially from Republicans and business groups in the state, to stop it. We'll hear cases for and against. We'll check out a Milwaukee area technical college program aimed at connecting people with autism to high-paying manufacturing jobs. And on this week's edition of Food Friday, grilling. Veggies, fruits, and desserts. That's all tomorrow here on Central Time. on Tuesday, we talked about cherished possessions in our lives, and we asked you to share yours. A lot of you called in, and some more of you joined in on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Brandy says, my Tedster Wedster. He isn't even a bear, though. I guess it's like a teddy bear. He used to be a cat. Brandy says, so my favorite item is my stuffed bear cat. Christine says, my grandfather's rocking chair. I have great memories of sitting with him on it, listening to the owls on the front porch of the family cottage. And Pete says, my grandparents' house, which I bought after they died and have lived in for 26 years. Pete says, my daughter's the fourth generation to call the house home. We also asked our Wisconsin Public Media colleagues for their stories of a treasured keepsake. Tom Blaine, production manager at WPR, says, I have quite a few musical instruments and have sold and traded in many over the years to get something different. However, I have an early Larrivée OM9 acoustic guitar that is the instrument equivalent of a favorite old flannel shirt. Also, Tom says, I have a favorite old flannel shirt. Lynn DeRoth, a video production specialist at PBS Wisconsin, shared some of her thoughts. She says, I tend to value items that I or someone I know made. Quilted wall hangings, cross-stitch ornament, a hope chest, or things that remind me of loved ones or fond experiences, like a set of measuring cups my still-living grandmother had hanging in her kitchen. Reminds me of baking cookies with her when I was a kid. You can keep sharing your keepsakes and stories over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.